a novel based on a famous photograph.
What interests me is the way that both photographs and also history are interpreted, and how there's sort of a limit to our ability to know the, you know, quote-unquote truth of anything.
That's Marissa Silver. We talk with her about her acclaimed new novel, Mary Coyne. It's about an iconic photograph of a migrant worker taken during the Great Depression. And a collection of short stories explores the Great Recession of current times.
These are very much Great Recession era stories, and I was sort of filled with the idea that in the Depression, which was the last great economic crisis this country faced, and I think people had a real sympathy for someone on having hard times. And I have felt in the last few years, especially, like when we see someone who's poor, we almost blame them for their own poverty. And I wanted to write about characters sort of on the fringe.
That's Jess Walter. We talk with him about his collection, We Live in Water. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When I was growing up, one of my favorite books was the collection of photographs, The Family of Man. And one of my favorite photos in the book was Dorothea Lange's iconic portrait, Migrant Mother. I pored over this photo, wondering, who was this person? What was she thinking as she gazed with such intensity off to the left of the camera? Well, we can never know. That's something the subject of the photo, Florence Owens Thompson, didn't explain when she came forth years later to complain to Dorothea Lange about the notoriety the photographer had brought her. But in her new novel, Mary Coyne, Marissa Silver has fashioned a sort of answer, albeit a fictional one. In a fascinating reinvention, Silver creates a new story about the photographer and her subject to explore the distance between the truth and our interpretation of it. It's also a story about the grit and endurance of the human spirit in hard times. And there's another story woven into the book, that of a contemporary academic researching the photograph, who finds out that his relationship to the subject of the photo is anything but academic. Marissa Silver is the author of several novels and short stories. We've spoken to her previously about her novel, The God of War, and her story collection, Alone with You. I started out our conversation with Marissa Silver by asking her to describe Dorothea Lange's iconic photograph, Migrant Mother.
The photograph is of a woman during the Depression. She's sitting underneath a very sort of ragtag tent, more like a lean-to kind of. She's holding a baby in her arms, and she, on either side of her, are two small children who are facing away from the camera, so you only see the backs of their heads. And she is looking away from the camera as well, but you know she's facing us, but she's looking off. And her expression is really complicated. It's both one of, I think, desperation and a kind of flinty resilience. And it's a photo that just has such mystery and pathos embedded in it that I think which is one of the reasons why it's captured people's imaginations for so many decades.
And what drew you to create a novel based on this photograph?
Well, I had seen the photograph, you know, many, many times over the course of my life. I'm sure the first time I saw it was probably in a history book in high school or something. But it's so ubiquitous. You know, you see it whenever the Depression is evoked practically, and it also was on a U.S. postage stamp, and certainly in any, you know, history of American photography that you're going to read or an exhibit that you're going to see, it's going to probably be included. But I had seen most recently the photograph about 4 years ago at the Museum of Modern Art, where it was included in an exhibit about Western photography. And, you know, once again, I was drawn to the photograph. But what really captured my attention this time was not simply the image, but the piece of information that was next to it on the curatorial information label, which said that the woman in the photograph did not reveal her identity until she was very old and quite ill and needed money for her medical care. And I was so struck by that piece of information because it just seems so curious to me that someone who is, you know, the subject of one of the most famous photographs of the 20th century would never have kind of claimed her legacy in that way. And then I thought to myself, well, why didn't she? You know, was she embarrassed by it or disenfranchised by it, or was she, did she, you know, what were the complicated feelings that made her not claim that she was the woman in the photograph? And that just set a whole sort of series of thoughts going in my head, and the book began to, bit by bit, be constructed. But then as I was writing the book, you know, initially I did a lot of research, both about Dorothea Lange, about whom much is known, and about the woman in the photograph whose name is Florence Owens Thompson, about whom comparatively less is known. But as I was writing the book, they became at a certain point fictional characters to me, because once I began to imbue them with emotional lives and interiorities, they moved away from being the people that I could understand through research into becoming the imaginative inventions that I wanted to make the subjects of my novel.
Well, you talk much in this novel, Mary Coyne, about the power of images and how they represent the world to us and how we interpret them. And, you know, when I said just before that I felt I understood this woman so much more than I had when I first saw the photograph, I feel I understand her because of the character you created out of her. So I'm really not understanding her. I mean, I don't know that much about her, and as you said, there's not that much written about her. Why do I feel, I'm going to ask you, maybe it's an unfair question, but why do I feel, or
why
does
do you feel the way you feel?
Why does the reader feel that they really understand this person now after reading this book?
Well, first of all, you know, that's a wonderful compliment, that, you know, because it represents kind of an engagement, which is what any writer loves to hear. I guess, you know, because I made the character of Mary Coyne through, you know, close attention to detail and a very particular experience of this invented person, I guess that I was able to bring her, quote unquote, alive on the page. But I think that the very difference between your sense of understanding Mary Coyne and your recognition that you actually don't understand any more about the woman in the photograph than you probably knew to begin with is exactly what I wanted to write about, because what interests me is the way that both photographs and also history are interpreted, and how there's sort of a limit to our ability to know the, you know, quote-unquote truth of anything, that we are, you know, our understanding is always going to be subject to our subjectivity and our own imaginations and what we bring to, you know, confronting anything, whether it's a stark fact of history or an imaginative retelling of something. It's immediately interpreted in the same way that when, you know, my character Vera Dare, who is the photographer in the book, stands in front of Mary Coyne to take a photograph, the fact of taking that photograph alters the reality. She chooses a composition, she chooses a distance at which to stand, she brings to it her own subjective impulses that make her photograph have a certain character, and so reality is instantly altered. And that's what interests me. I'm not interested so much in, you know, how near to the truth can we hew. I'm more interested in understanding the distance between the truth and the interpretation of the truth.
And yet in that interpretation of the truth, I mean, there are many different ways to interpret, and some are more authentic, it seems, than others. You base this character on a woman who lived in a very real time under very real circumstances, very difficult circumstances. I'd like you to talk a little bit about those circumstances that she found in her life, that is, your character that found in her life and must have been the migrant mother herself. And also, I guess just to put a point in here, that in some ways there's a greater truth that you can get to through this interpretation.
Yeah, well, what I did with the book was I used sort of the frameworks of both of the women's lives in as much as I could learn about them, and then invented on top of them. So it was sort of like an inventive elaboration on some facts. And the real character, Florence Thompson, like my character Mary Coyne, was raised in eastern Oklahoma on a subsistence farm, and she lived in a part sod house. She was quite poor. She was either half or entirely Cherokee. That's somewhat a subject of interpretation. But certainly she was a descendant of the Cherokee Indians who came to that part of the country on the Trail of Tears. So that was her legacy. And then she married a young man, and they moved to California before the Depression hit. They moved in the 20s. And at first they began to work in the lumber mills, the lumber yards, cutting down trees and milling the lumber. And then when the Depression hit and those jobs became scarce, they began to travel the roads as migrant farmers. And, you know, the conditions that they lived in, like so many of the people, certainly in California, if not the rest of the country, were desperate. I mean, you know, it got worse and worse as the times got worse and worse. So people were, you know, working for pennies for incredible backbreaking work. Children were sometimes educated in these, camp schools and sometimes not. Kids worked in the fields. You know, there wasn't a lot of medical care, you know, and so there were, you know, quite desperate situations. I think little by little, as the crisis both deepened and the government got more involved, there were some, you know, there were funds released and camps were set up and conditions were somewhat improved. But, you know, it was rock bottom for a lot of those people. But what interested me, you know, more than the kind of desperation of the moment for my character was the survival of the moment. You know, I'm kind of more interested in how people survive. I'm interested in endurance. And what struck me so much about that photograph and also about the lives of people I read about during that time was just the incredible will to endure in hardships that we can't really even imagine, even in our current economic moment. So that was really powerful to me. And, you know, when I read first-person accounts of people during that time or migrant farmers in California, one of the things that struck me was not only the descriptions of the hardships, but also the descriptions of the joy. People would remember dancing, and they would remember radios playing, and they would remember getting penny candy for their children on a Sunday with some extra money, and they remembered love. I mean, you know, families have this, you know, kind of above and beyond economic circumstance. There is this bond and that sometimes sees people through. So I think I was as moved by those things as I was by the hardship.
Mm. We're speaking with novelist Marissa Silver about her newest book. It's called Mary Coyne, and it's based on the famous photograph by Dorothea Lange of a migrant mother in the 1930s. One point, you know, I stared at this photograph. It's on the cover of the novel, Mary Coyne, for a long time, and it suddenly struck me. You know, I thought there was something different about it all the time. It suddenly struck me the photograph on the cover is in color.
Mm-hmm.
In the original,
you know, we thought a lot about how to present the photograph. Obviously, we wanted it to be on the cover, but we felt strongly that it needed to say something about how the book is representing that photograph. That it's not that it's an interpretation and an imaginative play on the photograph. So, what we chose to do was both to crop the photograph and also to colorize it. It sort of works its way up from being black and white into color. You know, a suggestion both that this is a contemporary rendering of a story, and also that, you know, the woman lived in color. She didn't live in black and white. And so it's really about a lived life. It's not about a something, you know, in a museum. So the cover sort of takes on more of a, I think, a kind of contemporary vibrancy.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are three major characters in the book. The second one is, of course, a photographer, Vera Dare. She starts out as a photographer of wealthy women. Was this also true of Dorothea Lange?
Yes, Dorothea Lange. A lot of the story of Vera Dare hews somewhat closely to the biography of Dorothea Lange. She grew up in New Jersey, and she suffered from childhood polio. And then she got interested in photography, and after working a little bit on the East Coast, she very bravely came west to San Francisco, and she set up shop as a portrait photographer and became quite successful as a photographer of sort of society folk.
And now Vera Dare, of course, is doing this as well. How does she get into photographing, and I guess how did Dorothea Lange get into photographing poor people during the Depression?
Well, I can probably only speak for my character, and you know, in terms of the emotions behind it. I don't know what the emotions for Dorothea Lange necessarily were, but you know, I think that part of what happens for Vera Dare in the story is that she begins to discover herself as someone with a particular point of view, and not just a portraitist. That she sort of looks out at the world. She begins to look out at the world around her, and when she experiences the effects of the Depression and sees what's happening, the combination of her beginning to sort of take herself seriously as an artist and also her social engagement and the fact that her marriage has fallen apart and so she's really moving out into the world on her own all combine to make her feel like what she needs to do is photograph what's going on around her. And in that moment, she discovers herself as an artist and herself as a someone who's socially engaged.
You also have then the third person who is a historian. His name is Walker Dodge. He rounds out the trio. Was he based on a real person or was he entirely made up?
The third character in the novel is Walker Dodge, who is an invented character. I felt strongly from the very beginning of the book that it was a book in three parts, that there were three major characters, and that one of them I wanted to be a contemporary voice, someone who was looking backwards, someone who had a kind of retrospective attitude. And then I began to look at that baby in the arms of the woman in the photograph, and I began to sort of think about who that baby might be and what could be the fictional life of that child. And out of that musing, Walker developed.
Mm-hmm. He emerges. Now, he's an integral part of the story itself, the narrative itself, but also I felt in some ways that he was a stand-in for you, or he was in some way, he wasn't a narrator, but he is, as you say, contemporary, and he's also the one who comments on the meaning of images for you.
Yeah. Well, he's a historian, and his subject is social history. So he's really interested in kind of the artifacts of history and the ephemera and what's left behind and using that information to construct the fabric of real lives. He's less interested in kind of the battles and the treaties and the presidential elections than he is in, you know, how people churned milk and what that had to say about the economics of the time. And yes, he is sort of a stand-in. He's sort of his process is really similar to what I went through. You know, what he undergoes as he begins to search the history of this photograph for very personal reasons paralleled a lot of what I was thinking about and doing while I was researching it, you know, thinking about what's the point of reinterpretation and how do we understand history and all those sorts of things, that he became the conduit through which I could explore those ideas.
Could you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, did you experience any kind of evolution in your thought or deepening in your ideas that you had started out with? What did you learn, in other words, through this process?
I guess what I learned was that we can both know and not ever know really what happened in the past, and that what we really can rely on at the end of the day is the empathy and sympathy of our imaginations to try to understand how the past, what it felt like to somebody living in it. And, you know, that there's a point at which the factual information doesn't tell the story that we need to know entirely, because we need to sort of feel the story and, you know, feel like we've had an immersive experience with it. So I guess that's what I learned, and that was very much the process of writing the book for me, you know, that I began to understand why I was writing this book. I wanted to understand a time in history, but I knew that in terms of my way of understanding things, you know, writing a fictional story, as you said before, might sort of edge up to an understanding that could be more resonant than just an understanding of the facts and figures of history.
And in some of the other novels that of yours that we've spoken with you about, there have been characters who have looked back on their earlier selves. Is this something that you wrestle with?
Yeah, because I think that, you know, we're always trying to figure out who we were and who is it that we were that made us who we are. And I think that I'm always struck by the fact that there's really kind of a point at which we can't know that information, and it's both an incredible frustration, but it's also a liberation, and it's also allows us to become who we want to be, that there is a sort of not an ultimate predestination, that there's a certain amount of choice and agency that we have in changing and becoming, you know, people maybe not only molded by our past, but also just, you know, people who make choices in the present. But yeah, I'm quite, you know, kind of fascinated by how much time we all spend in memory and what that really has to do with the present moment.
You know, I'm so glad you said that, because I was just telling someone the other day, I spend a lot of time in memory. Particularly, I'm living now in my mother's home. She died last year. So I can remember I was the first person there in that home when my parents first built it. I was 17. You know, when I was pregnant with my son, I was there. And I'm just so drawn. What is it, this feeling of yearning? I think there's a Portuguese word, saudade, you know, the sense of something that you really want to relive, and yet as you're remembering it, you are reliving it. That is the reality.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's all the reality that you have,
right,
is that memory. And yet there is probably a disjunction between your memory and whatever did happen back then. And as you say, the yearning is such a great word, because it's, you know, the desiring for something at the same time that you know that you can't ever have it. And I think that's one of the great, powerful emotions of our lives.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Marissa Silver about her newest novel, Mary Coyne. It's based on the iconic photograph, Migrant Woman, taken by Dorothea Lange of Florence Owens Thompson during the Great Depression. If it's okay, I'd love to read something here from your book. It's on page 302, almost nearly to the end. As you said, the original person, Florence Thompson, did write to Dorothea Lange, and in the novel, Mary Coyne writes to Vera Dare, and she gets an answer. Set us up a little bit here, then I'll read it. But she gets an answer from Vera Dare, an answer that kind of went through a number of iterations. I'd love it if you could talk about that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, as you say, the real Florence Thompson had written a letter to a magazine called U.S. Camera, like a cease and desist letter saying, stop publishing this photograph. I'm not getting anything for it. I'm not, you know, and it's a photograph of me, and you don't have a right to publish it. And unfortunately, she didn't have the power to stop that. And the photographs were actually, you know, government. They were for the government, so they were not, you know, she didn't have any recourse. It's kind of a very powerful photograph letter that she wrote, which I kind of changed a tiny bit, but it's essentially the same in the book. And then in my novel, when Vera Dare receives the letter, she's sort of tormented by it. She receives it very late in her life, towards the end of her life, and she's really suddenly tormented by something that she hadn't really considered, which was the effect that this photograph had on this woman, this photograph that changed Vera Dare's life as well, that made her famous, that gave her a photographic career, that, you know, had such a powerful effect on the world, and yet she hadn't sort of taken time to think about the effect of the photograph on this woman. So she struggles trying to respond to this letter, and she gets angry trying to respond to it, and she tries to respond to it in a way that will just sort of give nothing away. And, you know, there's a lot of emotions in the different ways that she responds, and this is one of them.
Right, and we actually don't really see it until the end of the book. Could I read it?
Yeah. Should I read it?
Yeah, that would be even
sure.
Better. Okay.
It says, Dear Mrs. Coyne, there is a sense you get when you have taken the right photograph. It is a feeling that you have lived the second of your life more completely than any other. The moment opens and you realize how much larger your life is than you thought it was, how much closer to a kind of, is it happiness? I don't know. I saw you and I recognized you the way you recognize people in your dreams, even if you don't know who they are. That's all a photograph is, really, a recognition. Very sincerely and with great sadness for the end of things, forgive me, Vera Dare.
This is such a powerful letter. I mean, it seems to really, it expresses a lot of what we've spoken about, but it also makes a connection between the two in a way that she's acknowledging how much the impact of the photograph, not on her career, but on herself.
Exactly, yeah, which I think is something maybe she hadn't really thought about until the end of her life, and until she was confronted in a way, not by the person herself, but by this letter that arrived in the mail unexpectedly, and suddenly, and it shakes her to the core and causes her to really reconsider what she's done and what the meaning of her photographs have been and what the moral quandaries of taking photographs of real people are.
Is it a little bit akin to writing about real people, even if you fictionalize them?
Yeah. You know, for me, the connection I have that with that is actually something that happened much longer ago in my life, when I started my career off as a filmmaker, and I made a documentary film about a family of fundamental Christians living in Indiana. I made the film with another filmmaker named Ricky Leacock. And as I was writing the book, I really reflected back on that experience so often, because I understood then and, you know, and now how, what strange kind of bargain that you make with a quote-unquote subject when you say, can I take your picture or can I make a film of you? And, you know, as honest as you can be and as forthright as you can be, and we certainly tried to be honest and forthright, you know, no one really understands the levels to which being exposed that way can change their lives. And, you know, certainly a photograph reproduced so many times or a film that shows to, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not more people, is a kind of exposure that most of us don't ever experience and can't really understand how that might change us or how it might change our sense of who we are. And so that was a really profound experience in my life. And when I was writing about Vera Dare and thinking about what it means to take a photograph of somebody and what it might mean for her, that experience in my life really came into play.
And then this letter is also in some way twinned in your novel, Mary Coyne, Marissa Silver, with a visit to a museum by Mary Coyne toward the end of her life.
Yeah, because she finally... No, I don't want to give away anything, but she, you know, toward the, at the very end of the book, she finally sees the photograph in a museum and has an incredibly powerful emotional reaction to it based on many things that have happened to her during the course of the novel.
And she also has, she thinks about the other photographs that are there that are also photographs of other workers like her that were taken in a similar context. And so she sees the difference between herself and them. I mean, without giving anything away, I wonder what was going through your mind or her mind. You know, what can you say about that, how she sees them differently and understands maybe a little bit more about the viewer than she had before?
Yeah, well, I think that when she sees these photographs, you know, being confronted with a photograph of herself and then confronted with a photograph of other people who were in similar situations but not herself, I think she's struck immediately by the difference between being the subject and not being the subject. And she can look at those other photographs with a kind of somewhat distanced view, the way that any viewer would, but the one that's of her is a completely other existential experience. It's, you know, it's looking at herself in a mirror, it's looking at herself trapped in a time of her life that she has moved beyond, but that this photograph, you know, brings everything rushing back. But I feel that way whenever I look at photographs. I mean, you know, I think about who are those people, and there they are for all time. And you know, one of the things that's interesting to me about thinking about photographs or looking at photographs is not just thinking about the image that's in front of me, but thinking about, you know, kind of what's beyond the margins of the image. What was the weather like? What did it smell like? What was happening? Was anybody watching while that photograph was being taken? It's kind of look around the corner. What else do you see? Is something that is interesting to me and part of what I hope the book accomplishes.
Well, it is just a spellbinding novel. Mary Coyne, we've been speaking with the author, Marissa Silver. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Marissa Silver is the author of two other novels, The God of War and No Direction Home, as well as two story collections, Alone with You and Babe in Paradise. We've spoken to her on Writer's Voice about The God of War, as well as Alone with You. You can hear our interview with her about Alone with You by going to writersvoice.net. And you can read an excerpt from Mary Coyne there, too. After the break, Jess Walter's story collection, We Live in Water. Don't go away.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Your mama's gone away and your daddy's gonna stay. Don't leave nobody but the baby. Go to sleep, you little babe.
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 Everybody's gone in the cotton and the corn. Didn't leave nobody but the baby. You're sweet little babe. Honey and the rock and the sugar don't stop. Gonna bring a bottle to the babe.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Jess Walter's last book was Beautiful Ruins, which took as its subjects the privileged, screen actors, writers, and those who cater to them. But Jess Walter himself came from a working-class family in the Pacific Northwest. His new collection of stories draws on those roots. Set in the Northwest, We Live in Water situates itself squarely within the realm of those who struggle to survive in America's Great Recession. To quote from the book's description, the stories in We Live in Water range from comic tales of love to social satire and suspenseful crime fiction. This is a world of lost fathers and redemptive con men, of personal struggles and diminished dreams. The stories are dark, yet profoundly compassionate. I cared about the characters, even when they were deeply flawed human beings. Jess Walter is the author of 6 novels, including the bestseller, Beautiful Ruins. I want to welcome you, Jess Walter, so much to for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about your new collection of stories, We Live in Water.
Thanks for having me.
These stories, I can't say that they were exactly cheerful. You know, they were fairly dark in certain ways, but I found them very profoundly human. I cared very much about the characters, even when they were rats. Could you talk a little bit about the kind of overarching sense? What is your view of the human character that you're getting at in these stories? And I know that's kind of a big question to start out with.
But. You know, I think part of that has to do with the time in which these stories were written. These are very much Great Recession-era stories. And I was sort of filled with the idea that in the Depression, which was the last great economic crisis this country faced, 1 out of 4 men were out of work. Women weren't even in the workforce. And I think people had a real sympathy for someone on having hard times. And I have felt in the last few years, especially, like when we see someone who's poor, we almost blame them for their own poverty. And I wanted to write about characters sort of on the fringe. Think about John Steinbeck's Cannery Row and Sweet Thursday and the humanity with which he dealt with difficult lives. But I also didn't want to shy away from the fact that some of these people had made mistakes and were in positions that they'd created for themselves. But I find the humanity of characters like that far more compelling than a short story about whether or not a banker makes it to his tea time on time. You know? maybe the short story writer shares something with the country music singer and that we're drawn to those harder lives. But those were the lives I wanted to write about, and I wanted to find that place where they just are beginning to make the first move toward redemption, toward understanding, possibly toward turning around a lifetime of mistakes.
So Gordon Gekko is really not your style.
Well, I mean, Gordon Gekko, after he's served his prison term, I'm interested in, when he's climbing from limo to limo. And it's partly the way I grew up. I come from a very blue-collar family. It's funny when people say to me, oh, these characters are lowlifes. I think they don't shop at the same grocery store I shop at. These are the people I know. Many of the stories came from things I saw. The first story in the collection, Anything Helps, which was also in Best American Short Stories this year. I was downtown, and a woman came up to me and my wife and asked if she could have $5. She said she'd been kicked out of her house and she had 3 kids she needed to feed and they didn't have anywhere to stay. And we were half a block from a liquor store, so it was really clear she was, you know, just going to take the money and go get booze. She smelled like she'd already had a few drinks, but something caused me to give her $5 anyway. And later, my wife and I were sitting in a restaurant, and I looked out the window, and there was this woman walking down the street with 2 grocery bags, followed by 3 children.
Wow.
And it broke my heart in such a way that I had become that crass and cynical. And again, it's not that maybe that woman had booze in one of those bags. You know, I wanted to look directly at those characters. I saw 2 meth addicts pushing a wheelbarrow down the street with a giant television on it, and it became the short story Wheelbarrow King. So, I think all we have to do is look at the world around us, and for me, writing is often an act of empathy, and reading too. When we are able to find ourselves immersed in another character's life, to me, that's when we're being our best as people.
You mentioned redemption, and redemption is not a simple a simple thing or something that you can say is, oh, a really nice feel-good kind of statement at the very end of a story, particularly not in these stories. It's a subtler form of redemption. And you mentioned Anything Helps. I mean, that's one of my favorite stories in the book. Tell us a little bit about that story and about the redemption that you see contained within it.
Well, when I started thinking about the panhandlers in my city, and there are a couple of corners where it's almost like shift work. You know, they line up and they wait for the person to leave that good corner because they want it. And so, you know, I talked to a few people, a little bit of research, and I came up with this character Bit. And in many of the stories, the sound is the thing that I go for. I loved, his name's Wayne Bittinger, but people call him Bit. And that beginning, Bit hates going to cardboard, and going to cardboard is pulling out a piece of cardboard and writing words on it and going and panhandling. And he hates doing that, but he's found himself at this place that he sometimes finds himself when, like a lot of my characters, when things come apart. And so Bit is, he's panhandling. A man pulls up in a car and says he'll give him $20 if he tells him what he's going to buy. And Bit, who's very funny, says he's going to buy the new Harry Potter book. And the man laughs at him and says, no, you have to really tell me what you're going to buy. And he says, well, I'll buy vodka because it messes you up the fastest, and I'll get a plastic bottle in case I drink it. And then, so he gets $20 for telling the truth. And then, of course, the next scene, he actually goes and buys the new Harry Potter book, which he's delivering to his son, who's in foster care. And in that story, I wanted, you know, Bit to be at this place where he's been wanting to buy this book forever, and he hasn't. Something's happened that's pushed him to finally go see his son in foster care and confront the way that his life has begun to unwind. And it would be, you know, I suppose the happy ending is, in a story like that, is, you know, look, his, you know, turns out his son has won the lottery, and you know, and they get back together. But you know, I also wanted this to reflect real lives, and for most of us, it's not, you know, redemption has nothing to do with how you end up. It's not a happy ending. It's mm-hmm. the moment of realization. It's the beginning of a journey, and I wanted for most of these characters to end with just the hint of their own awareness of the place that they've landed, their own culpability in it too. I don't mean to excuse, you know, people from the mistakes they make. But the other thing that I really want to do, to me, these stories are not about them, and that's why I chose the title "We Live in Water." They're about us. And if the terrorist attacks and the economic crisis taught us anything, it's that we all live a lot closer to the edge than we ever want to admit. And I think that's, you know, in the end, one of those, the rewards of that great fictional empathy that we get when we read.
Yeah, and that becomes very clear, actually, in the last story, Statistical Abstract. I found that very interesting. First of all, how it's written. Second of all, I wasn't really sure it was fiction.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. These stories were written over a 5-year period with no intent of putting them in a book necessarily. And I wrote dozens of other short stories, some of them expansive and funny. And when I went through, I found this grouping of stories that to me made a sort of arc. And when I thought about how to end it, I had no doubt in my mind that the thing to end it with would be this piece, Statistical Abstract, for my hometown, Spokane, Washington, which I wrote, you know, as an essay, I suppose. I mean, everything in there is true. That is the neighborhood I live in. That's the places that I go, the people that I see. I liked the idea of presenting a statistical abstract, which is a random grouping of stats meant to tell you about a place or a time. And I wanted this to be a statistical abstract in which a story almost bleeds into it. And by the end, it's no longer about statistics. It's about people. So as I wrote that piece, and as I looked at it, I realized that it functioned almost as a key for the rest of the stories. You know, it hopefully casts back upon this world we've just seen. And I think everyone drives past these people every day. We drive past people holding signs. We drive past mentally ill people with all of their belongings on a shopping cart. You know, every morning on garbage day, there are people, immigrant families who move up and down the alleys in my town, you know, trying to salvage what they can from the things we throw away. And rather than looking beyond those people, I wanted us all to live in water. I always wanted us all to be underwater the way we have been after the housing crisis, and, you know, and to look around and, you know, sort of realize, as I said, those people are us.
Right. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist and short story writer Jess Walter about his new collection of stories, We Live in Water. And going to that title story, here we have another father-son story, and I think that there is a father-son themes in a number of these stories in this book. And we have the character Orin Dessens, and his son asks him the question, do we live in water? And when I read that, I thought, well, what does he mean by that? So could you tell us, what does he mean?
Yeah, you know, I think it's, I think in... He's a young boy when he asks it, and I think his, you know, it comes about because we find out in the story he's been staring at this huge fish tank, and the fish tank is so large to a young boy that it seems to encompass the whole world. And as he watches the fish swim around in these circles, he imagines that we're all living like that, that we're all living in a kind of fish tank. And it becomes, you know, what becomes a sort of innocent question for a little boy, I think, becomes the answer to the father's life, because like those fish, he feels like he's moving around freely, but in fact he comes to the end of his tank and he can't go anywhere and he has to turn and go back, and he repeats these mistakes in his life and again realizes that at the end, you know, at this moment of the story is when he has the realization that even though he's felt as if he's been free, in fact he's been guided by you know, the walls of his own behavior, and in much the way that a fish, you know, feels like he's moving freely in a tank, but, you know, has these limits. And so I think that, you know, for me, that's what the story was about. It was one of those simple, perplexing questions that a child can ask that opens some existential door that, you know, that take you to real meaning.
Mm, I love what you say about that. Another father-son story, although we only find out about it later, and I don't want to give the ending away, is Thief. I guess I'd like to ask you, there's a very sudden switch on the story from the third person to the first person, and we are all of a sudden looking through the eyes of somebody who is now grown up when the story has actually taken place many years later. What can you say about that? What can you tell us about that story without giving us a spoiler?
Yeah. You know, that I don't teach very often, and I'm not actually I'm not adept at teaching. I like it, but I don't know if I'm a natural teacher. So a friend of mine had a writing exercise that he would give his students that I borrowed and would use, and it was to find something in your own past that you're either, you know, ashamed of or that frightens you in some way, and then to write it, but not from your point of view, but from the point of view of someone else. And so my idea was to take something in my past that I was ashamed of, and I really did steal money from my family's vacation fund, and write it from a different point of view. So I chose a character much like my father, although, you know, I fictionalized him in the story somewhat. And I decided it would be a sort of detective story, you know, a father trying to figure out which of his three kids would steal from their very limited vacation money, which of his three kids is a horrible sociopath. And as I worked on the story, it's incredibly freeing. And, you know, and as I said at the beginning, this, you know, I think of writing as a kind of act of empathy. And there's no better test of that than to take something you remember from one vantage and try to write about it from another one. And so when I got to the end of the story and I thought I was thinking more about that exercise, the ending just revealed itself to me in the form of the exercise.
It was great.
Thank you.
Now, these stories very much have most of their characters, and their main characters are men. You know, it's interesting to hear you talk, because as I was reading them, I was thinking, well, this author has a pretty jaundiced view of men. And yet, and yet what I'm really hearing from you now is a lot more compassion for your characters than I might have thought. The state of men in America and in your stories, and how you relate to it as a male writer, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm always surprised that people, you know, who find these characters, you know, dark or unredeemable, or, you know, to me they just are human, and I find frailty and failure to be the most human things of all, and those are the characters I connect with the most. the two, you know, meth addicts trying to find a trying to pawn a giant television that is, you know, pushing it around town in a wheelbarrow. At one point, one of them says, you know, as they think back on their almost Homeric day, one of them says, maybe remembering is better than living. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to write to a point where a character says something that profound just really connects me with the people I write about. But I don't know that the state of the American male is in any sort of crisis, you know, maybe any more than it ever was. Certainly you can look at hard economic times and see, you know, that there does become a crisis. The birth rates fell precipitously during the Great Depression because men without work, you could almost be watching a Nature Channel show. They don't become good breeders at that point. You know, there's a reason that the war boom took place after the victory in World War II because, you know, the men returned with jobs, with purpose. And the men in these stories are lacking purpose. I don't think they're lacking in humanity and caring for one another in their desire to do better. I think the father in Thief is a wonderful father. I think the father in the three short stories, Tommy, is doing his best in hard circumstances. And that's what I would say about most of these people is they have not gotten, you know, the opportunities and the breaks that a lot of us get, and they're making the most of difficult lives.
Yeah, and I think for, you know, I'd say the largely white men that you write about, you know, maybe what has happened to them is that the place in the world that they thought they were going to have is not there, whereas maybe for other groups, you know, that place, well, it was kind of clear the place was always a little bit further back.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to really decry the plight of white men in America. but
it's a real one.
Yeah, it is a real one. And for these individuals, and I also think it transcends race, you know, and there are men in the book who, you know, whose race we don't know or who aren't white. So I wrote specifically these stories about men and grouped them about men. They aren't the only stories I write. But as I looked back, as I said, these stories felt to me like of a piece. And I like story collections that, you know, I really like linked story collections, but I also like those that connect in a thematic way. And that's what I was trying to do. So, you know, I sort of clung to the stories that, you know, I guess in some ways are about men behaving badly, but, you know, hopefully longing for better.
And one of the ones that I really loved, I guess, with a woman's sense of ha, comeuppance, is Helpless Little Things.
Yeah.
Tell us about that story. It's quite a delicious one.
Yeah, there are a couple of stories in here that I think comes really from a noir tradition, you know, both those Portland stories, Virgo and Helpless Little Things. Helpless Little Things is about, you know, it's begins with a profanity aimed at the city of Portland, you know, for its uber coolness. And it's about a drug dealer who has a scam where he puts a couple of homeless kids on the corner in Portland raising money for Greenpeace. He's stolen some Greenpeace materials, and he knows that people in Portland will give money. And so the scam works really well until one of the homeless kids he falls for, this thin, waifish girl named Julie, who has her own surprises in store for him. And I think it falls, you know, it's one of those classic noir stories in which, you know, things aren't exactly what they seem.
Right. Now, you received a lot of acclaim for your novel, Beautiful Ruins, which is a very different kind of setting. Did that novel or the success that you got with that, did that change anything about how you work or write?
I don't think so. You know, I've had probably since Financial Lives of the Poets, the novel before that. And actually, you know, it's been such a gradual growth. I started out, you know, growing up in this blue-collar place without a master's degree in fiction writing, without any connections. You know, I think I've always felt outside the literary mainstream and just sort of working my way up and, you know, writing every day. I write 7 days a week every morning. You know, I just finished my work this morning when you called. So whether I'm on the road, wherever I am. So I don't think it's changed the way I work. You know, with Citizen Vince winning the Edgar Allan Poe Award and then Beautiful Ruins as a National Book Award finalist and, you know, and Financial Lives of the Poets getting quite a bit of acclaim and selling pretty well. It really has felt to me like this gradual movement, and yet the books aren't, I'm not timing them in any way. They're, you know, I started Beautiful Ruins 15 years ago before I finished any of my other five novels, and the stories in We Live in Water predate, you know, some of the other novels. So, you know, I've just been writing these things, and it's been incredibly rewarding to have people respond to the work. I mean, that you dream of that as a writer, and you sort of get used to the opposite, which I think is kind of a good thing, to be writing, you know, for yourself in a way, to be, you know, I take great pride in the fact that people say, I was just did an interview yesterday in which the interviewer said, you know, if I held up We Live in Water and Beautiful Ruins, I wouldn't believe that it was the same author. And I take that as a great compliment. I feel like it's less about the author and more about the story, and the story sort of tells me how it wants to be told. And I think, you know, sort of living off the literary grid has allowed me to, you know, to really focus on the things I'm working on and less on, you know, myself as a tweeting author, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're lucky that way, I think, in some ways, because it does seem to be an increasing struggle for authors to, you know, gain a little bit of space in which to be seen. But I wanted to, you know, I'm a journalist because I don't just do this radio show. I also have been a radio reporter, and now I write for an online publication. And I've often thought about fiction and just feel like, you know, journalism and fiction, I couldn't do it. I don't even know how to do dialogue. Yet you really span those. I mean, you did a book about the Randy Weaver Ruby Ridge case, which got some real acclaim. And so I wonder if you could talk about those two genres, how you bring them together, what you see in common about them, and what might be quite different for you when you write in one versus the other.
Well, they're very different, obviously. Probably the biggest thing is when you write in journalism, the voice is given to you. You know, you don't ever think, well, what should this sound like? Because there's that voice of authority that comes with writing for a newspaper or writing for the radio. You know, it comes with that place. You aren't usually embodying characters and their feelings. So there are many differences. For me, you know, I started working at newspapers at 19 because I was a father very young and, you know, and couldn't really afford to just, I always wanted to be a novelist, but I couldn't really afford to go live in a van and write poetry while I waited for, you know, from the genius to strike. So for me, I went to work at a newspaper, and it turned out to be the greatest thing. And I found these tools for fiction writing that I didn't know. The first one being just the ability to produce copy to write, which it's amazing how many fiction writers just, you know, that they can't do the sort of basic show up for work and put the words down. And I think working in journalism is like being a piano player in a kind of dive bar. You know, you sit there at this plinky piano and you have to play, you can only play what people request, you know, so they're going to keep asking for the Pina Colada song when you'd rather be writing a sonata or something. But yet you get your chops. You can play fast. You can play all the time. You're unafraid of publication. But more than that, I think journalists, when they write fiction, write with a real curiosity about the world. They aren't just sitting inward, you know, staring at themselves, you know, writing coming age novel after coming of age novel, trying to figure out their childhoods. A career in journalism teaches you to ask questions, to understand how institutions work, to really look out at the world. And so I think, you know, as much as I love MFA programs, I feel like, you know, if you could govern such things that 20% of novelists should come out of journalism, just so we keep that sort of viewpoint alive. As far as the writing itself, they really are different. And I was writing fiction and sending out short stories the whole time I was working in newspapers. I tried never to combine the two. You know, there were no short stories in the newspaper, but the technique and craft and the style and all of those things are very much separate from the sort of nonfiction writing. And the pace is so different. I mean, you know, as I said, I worked on Beautiful Ruins for 15 years. And when I would see, when I first started telling my journalist friends that I was writing fiction, they would, you know, they'd see me 4 days later and say, well, where's that novel? You know, because in newspapers, you know, you write something and it shows up the next day. And I'd say, well, I'm still working on it. And they would look at me dubiously, like, right, you know, so.
And 15 years, that is a very long time. What happens over the span of 15 years? I mean, first of all, your writing must have changed in many ways. How do you keep the integrity of something over that long span?
Well, most of those 15 years, I didn't work on the book. I mean, most of those that time, it was a failure, and four other novels came out during that period, five actually. So, you know, I would start it and set it down, and when I would go back to it after a year, year and a half spent on something else, I would suddenly see it clearer. I would know what didn't work. So there isn't a single sentence that exists that is the same from that version that I started in 1997 or from the version that I went back to in 2003 or from the entire draft that I finished in 2007. Entire chapters, you know, I threw out entire sections, rewrote on a sentence level every bit of it. So when you go back to it, you make it a different book. But I tend not to throw anything away, and the novel, Beautiful Ruins is about loss and about the sort of the large scope of our lives, about the primacy of one moment in our lives. And I don't think I could have written that at 30, 32, 34. I don't think I'd lived enough, lost enough, experienced failure. It was only after, and so I think that long period that it took to write the book in some ways was necessary. Although you don't know that as a writer during those 15 years, I did not think of it as this is my secret weapon. I can't wait till this came out. But I thought of it as a failure that I had never gotten my arms around. I have one book I've been working on even longer than that. And I go back to it in between books. It's the one thing, and I think it goes back to my journalism training, I don't leave the desk. So if I'm stuck on one thing, I switch over to something else. And I don't even sweat it. I think, well, that's not working for me today. So I go write a poem, or I go into a short story, or I go work on a script, or I write a book review. Or when I'm at the desk, I work. But I don't force it because, you know, staring at a blank page, moving three or four words around doesn't work for me. And I've learned that the further I get from something, the more perspective I get, and I'm just not in a hurry anymore.
Oh, that's wonderful. So you're working on one novel that you've been working on for a long time. Is there something else that you think might be coming up even sooner than that one?
Yeah, I've been working on a novel. I come from a long line of cattle ranchers, and there was a point where my father realized that he was never going to make enough money, and so he worked at an aluminum plant. He commuted 60 miles each way from our farm to an aluminum plant, and he realized he couldn't do that anymore, and we had to move to town. And so he decided we would bring some cows with us. So this is a story about a suburban cattle ranching family. And I've been working on it for about 20 years, and I come in and out of it, and I don't even know if I'll ever finish it, but there are parts of it that really make me laugh, and then when I come back to it, I have, you know, different ideas for it. I'm also working on a novel that, like Beautiful Ruins, has a whole lot of characters sort of swirling in and out, so that one I might finish first. I'm writing short stories. The process to me tends to be more important than the result, and when something hooks me, I know, because I get so immersed in it, that's the only thing I want to write, and right now I'm just not hooked by any of these larger things.
Jess Walter. He's the author of six novels, including the bestseller Beautiful Ruins. He was a finalist for the 2006 National Book Award for The Zero and winner of the 2005 Edgar Allan Poe Award for Citizen Vince. I spoke to him in March about his latest book, the collection of short stories, We Live in Water. You can read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.